Ohio Democrats are taking a victory lap this week after Tuesday's election. But what do these wins mean for next year's statewide races? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, how Ohio Democrats and Republicans are interpreting this week's results, plus Ohio's child labor laws, a Batavia Township development is halted by voters, a Covington police officer who punched a protester in the head is placed on unpaid leave, and what do Bengals fans have to hope for this season? Joining me now to discuss news from Columbus is Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Welcome back, Karen.
Hey, great to be here.
Great to have you. Karen, Democrats won big in Cincinnati on Tuesday. How did they do elsewhere in Ohio?
Well, there was another mayor's race in Cleveland where incumbent Justin Bibb, the Democrat there, beat a Republican challenger. Now, Democrats have said this is all very good news. This and some other signs that they saw throughout the state, a couple of other races. They feel like this is good news for next year because there weren't any statewide contests this time around and no major issues that are on the state level. But this is what a lot of people would call an off-year election, which I don't believe in. I think that you should be voting in every election.
Amen, Karen.
So now Democrats are looking at that and the results nationally of what happened on Tuesday and saying this potentially forecasts a very good year for Democrats next year when they have a race for governor, also U.S. Senate, the entire Ohio House, half the Ohio Senate, and Ohio's 15 members of Congress, as well as the Supreme Court contest. So, you know, Democrats are saying this could be the best year they've had since 2006, which they haven't had very many good years since 2006. And in fact, when you go back to 1994, 82% of statewide candidate contests have been won by Republicans. So Democrats have really wanted and looked for a win, and they say next year is an opportunity potentially.
Are there particular issues Ohio Democrats plan to focus on in the run-up to next year's elections?
I think a lot of Democrats in Ohio and nationwide are really looking at the questions of the issues that affect working people and affordability. I mean, that's what even Vivek Ramaswamy, who is likely to be the Republican nominee for governor, has said that Republicans need to focus on affordability and the cost of things and bringing those down. And so you're going to see a lot of that talk, I think, on both sides from both the candidates in all the major races. Because that's really the stuff that people are concerned about. That's what polls have continually shown. And I mean, you go way, way back, the economy is always a big issue.
Well, you talked about how long it's been since Democrats in Ohio had a really good year. How big of an uphill battle will statewide races be for Democrats in 2026?
I think it's going to be difficult. I mean, right now you do have a Senate race that appears to be largely decided in terms of Republican incumbent John Houston running against Democratic challenger, former Senator Sherrod Brown. So that looks like that race is set. The race for governor, that may change. Vivek Ramaswamy on the Republican side has pretty much driven out all other Republican candidates. But Dr. Amy Acton on the Democratic side, she's been running since January. There's a possibility, and it's looking more and more likely, that former Congressman Tim Ryan is going to enter that race, which was set up an expensive primary, could be a bitter primary. So that's one thing that we're looking at. There's also a contested Democratic primary for Secretary of State between Brian Hambly from Cincinnati, who's a doctor of oncology, and former Ohio House Minority Leader Allison Russo. On the Republican side, there's a pretty interesting rivalry going on in the race for treasurer, but Democrats don't have anybody in that race, no candidate right now for treasurer or for auditor. So Democrats do have some work to do in terms of filling out that ballot and then, of course, getting the message out there.
How did the state's Republican Party leadership react to these Democratic wins on Tuesday?
Well, Republican Party Chair Alex Triantafilou, who, of course, used to be the Hamilton County Republican Party chair, said it wasn't a big surprise that Democrats won in Democrat areas. I think that was either him or it was House Speaker Matt Huffman, also a Republican. But that's been the response, I think, from a lot of Republicans is Democrats won in blue states, Democrats won in blue areas, that there shouldn't be any trend or forecasting based on just this election. And I think that there is the question about whether you can look at what happened on Tuesday and definitively say, that this is a good sign for either party going forward, because a lot can change. I mean, we're seeing the economy and the impacts of the shutdown, federal government shutdown, and how people are viewing the shutdown in real time. And so we just have no idea what's going to happen between now and a year from now.
Well, you mentioned the importance of voting in every election. A lot of people vote absentee, and a bill related to absentee ballots could have an impact on next year's election. What would that bill do?
Well, this was a bill that passed the Ohio Senate this week with all Republicans except for one, Senator Bill Blessing from Coleraine Township. He voted against it along with all the Democrats. This bill would change the four-day grace period that people have to get their absentee ballots back to the Board of Elections. It would eliminate that and say that all absentee ballots must be received by Boards of Elections by Election Day for them to be counted. Except for military and overseas voters, they got a carve out in this. But basically, Republicans have argued that 34 other states have this rule, that there's no reason why we have a month of early voting, and therefore ballots should be received by Boards of Elections on Election Day so they can be counted and business can be wrapped up on Election Day. Democrats have said this is a problem for people who rely on the mail system and really don't have any control over, they put their ballot in the mail a month ahead of time and somehow something happens, the mail in many cities, most of the state actually goes out of state and then comes back in after it's processed. So they say that this could disenfranchise thousands of voters, and they're concerned.
If this had been law last year, what impact would it have had?
We have Senator Bill DeMora, who's a Democrat of Columbus, saying that some 10,000 votes would have been tossed out if this bill had been law last year. And I mean, that does bring up the point of, okay, if you are voting absentee, what do you do? And Democrats have pointed out that there are bills, including one that's being discussed, that would really restrict, if not eliminate, ballot drop boxes, which people have used, and those, the hours of those have been pulled back, and there's a real concern about what will happen to people who rely on the things that we've seen going back several years in terms of drop boxes and early voting and having a little bit more freedom to get your ballot returned. If you change that, what's going to be the impact?
What does Senator DeMora think is the motivation behind all this?
Well, Democrats in general feel like the motivation is to try to limit the number of people who can vote. I mean, there were the testimony on this and another bill that would do a lot more. It would require proof of citizenship to register to vote. It would ban these ballot drop boxes. It would do a lot of things. The opponents of that bill have said it would change some 40 areas of state law that relate to election law, and say that this is really confusing, and the whole goal is to try to suppress voter turnout and try to put roadblocks in front of people who want to vote but are not the typical voter who can vote on Election Day, say. So this is a struggle that Republicans and Democrats have been having for a while, where Republicans really have seemed to want to move toward a more uniform, maybe even Election Day only voting. But Democrats have wanted to keep what has been there since we expanded early voting. And, you know, we don't still know who actually uses early voting, whether it benefits Republicans or Democrats. I don't think that there's ever, in fact, I know there's never been a definitive poll or study showing that one party benefits more than the other.
Well, you mentioned that this passed out of the Ohio Senate. It now goes on to the House. Any idea what kind of support it has there?
Well, I know that my colleague Joe Ingles spoke to Governor Mike DeWine about this yesterday, and DeWine had said more than a year ago that he did not want to sign any more election-related laws because he feels like the laws that are in place right now are working just fine, that Ohio's elections are working just fine. And so she asked him about this. He said he will be looking at this potentially if it comes to him after it passes the House, and wants to look at it carefully. But he still is a little bit wondering why these laws to change existing election laws need to be pushed forward. And it should be said, too, that voter fraud, while that is the underlying discussion through all of these, voter fraud is extremely rare. It's never been a significant problem. I mean, we're talking about rare to the point of 0.000%, way, way down the list.
Well, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of debate about that. There's also been ongoing debate over child labor laws in Ohio. What changes have lawmakers just approved there?
Well, this was a bill that was started in the Senate, was approved there, and just got approved this week in the House. It would allow 14 and 15-year-olds to work after 7 o'clock year-round. They could work until 9 o'clock with permission of a parent or a legal guardian. Now, the state can't do this on its own. Federal government has to change the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is a law that's been in place for 90 years. And so this proposal to change the hours that 14 and 15-year-olds can work was paired with a resolution that urges Congress to go ahead and change that Fair Labor Standards Act. And I haven't heard yet whether DeWine will sign this. DeWine's always been very concerned about kids, but this is a bill that Republicans say is something that is a good idea, that it kids want to do this. Families are interested in this. It's permissive. It's not required, of course. But Democrats have said this is not a way to solve Ohio's problem in terms of finding people who need jobs, because you can't basically hire your way out of a problem with 14 and 15-year-olds.
Well, I want to switch gears a bit. Two Republican members of the Ohio House want to remove a judge from the Hamilton County Municipal Court. Why is that?
Well, this judge, Ted Berry, made some comments after the assassination of conservative commentator Charlie Kirk that they found really offensive. And there's been a lot of social media outcry against this judge and a lot of posts about whether he should be removed. And so Representatives Adam Matthews from Lebanon and DJ Swearingen from Northeast Ohio from Huron proposed a resolution that would basically say that he should be removed. And that's right now you've got Democrats who are saying that he's already said that he's going to retire. It's not necessary. And that the voters don't get a chance to decide on him again. So that this is not something that really needs to move forward. And even House Speaker Matt Huffman, who is a Republican, has said that since Barry has announced that he will retire, this is probably not going to move forward. But Huffman also said that he thinks some judges are too vocal, and that can be a problem.
Well, I think Judge Barry's been on the bench for something like 20 years. Isn't this something the Ohio Supreme Court would normally handle?
That I'm not entirely certain of. I mean, certainly there are rules for judges. But, you know, this is one of those stories that we saw after the assassination of Kirk that came forward, where people were making comments that really looked like that they were really problematic for some folks. And so I'm not exactly sure what the Ohio Supreme Court can and might do, but I think part of it is just basically that this judge is retiring. And so while there are these two Republicans who feel like they want to move this forward, it's really seen as something that's probably not going to move too much further.
Well, let's talk about Governor DeWine again. He wants a ban on prop bets. First, explain what prop bets are.
Well, and I can't tell you if I don't know the difference between micro prop bets and prop bets. But basically, what we're talking about is betting on a specific action that an athlete can take in a game, and that the bet settles as soon as that play is over. So we're talking about very specific actions during a game. And Governor DeWine has said that he's been very concerned about this kind of betting. He ordered it banned on college athletes last year. And part of the problem was a lot of these athletes were getting death threats for actions that were happening on the field. And so DeWine wanted to protect those athletes with that, but says that there's a real problem here. And you've even seen, I saw a post on X this morning from a player for the New York Giants talking about how he gets death threats for things that happen during games because people are betting on specific actions. And so DeWine said, after the World Series was over, which it is over now, so we should see something on this, that he had talked with the commissioner of Major League Baseball, who said that, again, after the World Series was over, there would likely be some movement to ban prop betting with the, like, not the state doing it, but with Major League Baseball and the sports gambling companies doing it. And he said that DeWine told me that he had all, that the Major League Baseball commissioner had all but one sports gambling operator on board with this. But DeWine also said that other leagues should be looking at it. He said he's gotten calls from the NFL. And with the NBA, there was just a high profile arrest of a coach and a former player and I think even a current player in connection with an illegal sports gambling ring. And so DeWine says all major league sports should be concerned about this kind of activity.
Well, one more thing I want to talk to you about, and that is we've talked a lot about homeowners' frustrations with rising property taxes in Ohio, and now a Republican-backed bill wants to address that through library levies. Tell us how that would work.
Well, this is a bill that's just in committee, so it hasn't even gone out onto the floor. It's not law, but what it would do is it would allow a local taxing authority, say county commissioners, to look at a library levy, in other words, a levy that passed a library's board of trustees, and decide whether that levy should go to voters. Because right now the mandate is that if the library board of trustees says they're going to seek a levy, it is presented to voters. It's put on the ballot. And so this bill would allow this taxing authority to step in and say, well, we don't think this is the right time. We feel like our voters are already overburdened. And the Republican sponsor of this bill has said this could potentially give library levies and also general health district levies are covered with this as well. It would give them a better shot of passing. For instance, you know, if a taxing authority said that this is a levy that doesn't stand a very good chance in this current economic environment, then they would move that from the ballot because they wouldn't want it to fail. But libraries say they need these levies and they don't want to do these, but the state library fund money doesn't cover all that they need. And voters are saying they want the opportunity to vote on library levies. 92% of library levies over the last 15 years have passed. So library levies have shown to be popular. And I'm getting a lot of feedback on this story because people have said they want the opportunity to support their local library.
Well, and Republicans, it sounds like, if I understand their argument, they're saying, hey, this could be one way to kind of remove some of this burden of property taxes from homeowners. Are they arguing that they don't think libraries are important? It doesn't sound like that's necessarily what they're saying.
No, I think what's happening is that you've got Republicans and you know, Republican state lawmakers who are struggling with the idea of helping people who are suffering under property tax bills that have soared, saying that maybe we need to make some different rules for property tax levies. And so you've seen some other moves for bills that would kind of change, for instance, what kind of levies can be put before voters. I mean, I believe the replacement levies have been banned, for instance. And so, you know, this is, it seems like an effort to try to change the kind of levies that voters see. But then the question becomes, should voters get that opportunity and decide for themselves?
You mentioned that this is in committee. What's next with this? What are the steps with this whole thing?
Well, I'm sure that the next committee meeting will be very interesting. So it's one of those bills that we are following because there are a lot of measures, as there have been over the last couple of years, to try to deal with property taxes. And I think the struggle has been all along, what is the state going to put toward property tax relief versus what are local communities going to have to put toward property tax relief? Because universally, everybody says they want to help property taxpayers who are really suffering with these high bills. But the question is, who's going to pay for that? And if not, where are the cuts going to come from?
Right. Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Thank you so much for your time today, Karen. I hope you get some R&R this weekend.
Great to talk to you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Up next, a Covington police officer who punched a protester in the head gets placed on unpaid leave. This is Cincinnati Edition. You might have seen the video of Covington police clashing with protesters on the Roebling Suspension Bridge in July. Now the Covington police chief has taken action against one of his officers. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to explain is WVXU long-form reporter Nick Swartzell. And with us also to discuss election results in Batavia Township is Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Victoria Morwood. Welcome back, Nick and Victoria.
Hey, Lucy.
Thanks for having us.
I appreciate you both being here. Nick, I want to start with you. We talked with you in July after a rally in Cincinnati led to a march across the Roebling Bridge and a clash with Covington police. Remind us what happened that day.
Yeah, so this started as a rally organized by local sort of immigration advocacy groups like Ignite Peace, protesting the arrest and detention of Imam Ayman Soliman. He's a Egyptian immigrant and local faith leader. At the time, he was in Butler County Jail on an ICE detention because his asylum had been revoked. That rally then kind of morphed into a march that wasn't organized by the initial groups across the Roebling Bridge. This was an unsanctioned march. And Covington police came across the bridge to meet the protesters about halfway, issued orders to disperse, and in short order started arresting people.
You took video of an officer and a protester who was face down, I think, on one of the bridge's walkways. Tell us what happened in that video, what you saw.
Yeah, so during the initial kind of interaction between police and protesters, people started getting over to the side. Some people were not getting over to the side. Officers were using non-lethal devices like pepper ball guns and I believe tasers to kind of probably encourage people to get over to the side of the bridge. As that happened, one person who we now know is named Brandon Hill was just on the walkway, the east walkway, and had already been interacting with an officer. The officer shot him with a pepper ball gun a couple times and then began hitting him. Hill ends up on the ground face down. The officer is still hitting him in the video you can see, and I saw in person. Eventually, he's handcuffed. Some other people try to kind of intervene. They are also arrested, and then they're kind of taken away.
How did police at that point or in the days afterwards explain Officer Staten's, this was the police officer who was punching the guy, right?
Zachary Staten is his name.
Officer yeah. Zachary Staten. How did they explain his reaction and his behavior?
So overall, Covington police say, you know, this was a chaotic scene. We issued these orders to disperse, and those orders were not immediately followed by everyone. And so that's kind of the general reason for their reaction that they've given. In Brandon Hill's specific case, there are claims by officers that he grabbed at the pepper ball gun and that he reached into a bag and they thought maybe he had a weapon or something like that. Later, some body camera video was released that is a little inconclusive about that. And Hill and others who were there kind of they say that's not what happened. So it's a little unclear exactly what went on. But those are kind of the reasonings that police gave.
So what did Covington police announce this week?
So this week, the chief of police for Covington said that Zachary Staten, the officer who arrested Hill and punched him multiple times, has been suspended for 30 days without pay in relation to his actions on the bridge. And then the chief also said that the rest of the department behaved according to procedure and that, you know, it seemed like due to their their investigation found that, you know, there was no other procedural wrongdoing or anything like that.
Okay. Did the police chief explain more specifically why Officer Staten was suspended?
No, he gave his statement in front of the Covington City Commission, and it was a pretty brief statement. And it just kind of like went through, hey, we did this investigation. We looked at hundreds of hours of body camera footage. We talked to witnesses. And generally what we found is the officers did what they were supposed to do, except Officer Staten, who is going to be on the suspension.
Okay. I know a couple of journalists were arrested during this whole thing. We've talked to you about that. Where do their cases stand?
So one of the journalists, Lucas Griffith, he has already stood trial and he was convicted of one of, I believe, four misdemeanor counts. The other three he was found not guilty on, and that was failure to disperse. That was just a fine. So his case is through. And then the other journalist, Madeline Finnig, these are both reporters for CityBeat. She stands trial in January for some misdemeanor charges.
Okay. Are there any other people who were arrested during this whole thing and are still waiting to stand trial?
Yes. Overall, including the journalists and Brandon Hill, 15 people were arrested. Most of those folks either pled down or they had their charges dismissed. Four still stand accused of felony charges. That's in the grand jury process right now, so the grand jury is considering those particular charges.
Okay. And you said there's no indication that any other Covington police officers could face any administrative action or anything in connection with this?
No, but the chief did say that there will be some de-escalation and response to unlawful protest training that all officers will receive. And that Officer Staten, in addition to his suspension, will get some remedial training. Not exactly clear what that means, but, you know, we'll request more about that and find out.
Okay. Well, thank you for that update. We sure appreciate it. Victoria, I want to turn to you now. Tell us about the farmstead development that was planned for Batavia Township, where it was planned, how big it was going to be.
Yeah, so Farmstead was a planned 239-home development. It was going to go up on agricultural land in Batavia Township, which is a sprawling greater Cincinnati suburb. Around 27,000 people live there. Trustees of the township had approved zoning changes in order to allow the development to go forward. But on election night, residents voted to reject those zoning changes. And so now Farmstead will not be able to go on as planned. That sends developers back to the drawing board, back to the approval process, or they may nix the plan altogether.
You mentioned this vote by residents. Was this the kind of thing where residents had to gather signatures to get it on the ballot, kind of like what we saw in Cincinnati for the Hyde Park Square development?
Right. They gathered petitions. They got this referendum on the ballot as well as another resolution. It's really the latest example that we're seeing in Greater Cincinnati of residents fighting development and growth in their community. And it's highlighted this clash between, you know, the need for housing in these areas and residents' desire to slow down that growth.
And this was a big plot of land. What's there now? Is it farmland? The picture that I saw in the Enquirer looked like cornfields or something was growing there.
Yeah, it's a lot of lots that are just, they were zoned for agricultural use, former farmland that the landowner was ready to let go of. But so we'll see. I spoke to the current owner, and he still wants to push forward with some kind of housing, but they're going to have to restart the approvals process. I'm not sure if the developer is going to stay involved now that this vote has gone through. So we will kind of have to wait and see what will be the future of that land now.
You mentioned how in Greater Cincinnati, there are a lot of these debates going on about, you know, development and land that's not developed yet. In Batavia Township in particular, is it typical for former farmland to be converted into subdivisions like this? Is this something that happens a lot or has happened a lot?
So a lot of land in Batavia is zoned for agricultural use. And so to get these subdivisions into these lots, developers need to get new zoning changes from the trustees. And so on election day, voters banned these, they're called planned developments. And so that means that developers will now have to build subdivisions within the existing zoning rules. So this is a thing that's popping up a lot in this township. There's lots of space, but it has to be the zoning for it has to change in order to get these subdivisions in. And residents said, no, we don't want that to happen.
So you mentioned that voters, you know, struck down this farmstead development. What was the case that opponents of the development really made to voters? What was their argument?
Mostly worries about traffic, maintaining the rural character of the area, the density. They say houses are being built too closely together, and a potential impact of all these new residents on local services. So fire, schools, and police.
And who owns the land where the farmstead development was supposed to be built? Have they said anything about what the plans are for the land now after this vote?
So the landowner actually lives across the street from this plot of land. And when we talked to him before the vote, he said he was going to continue. He said housing is needed in Claremont County. It's needed in Batavia Township. He wants to get homes on that lot. But now that plan is going to have to change quite a bit since voters rejected the zoning amendment.
This zoning amendment, is that tell us about this other petition-led measure on the ballot. Is that something it's not limited to Farmstead? That one's more comprehensive, right?
Right. So that petition-led resolution essentially bans planned developments in the whole township. So that changes how developers can ask for zoning changes in the township. It changes where they're going to be able to build subdivisions. So voters, you know, chose to ban that. Election results will be certified on November 21st. So that will be when this new ban goes into effect. But that is going to have a big impact on how developers can create these subdivisions in the township.
But meanwhile, township trustees met Wednesday. And were they considering other developments like the ones that these people have opposed, the voters have opposed?
Yes. So interestingly, the day after the election, township trustees approved zoning changes for two more planned developments. So the same thing that voters had just banned, trustees approved two more of them. And that's because they were submitted, the proposals for those plans were submitted well before the election. So, you know, they were allowed to approve them. But as you might imagine, voters turned out to this, or residents turned out to this trustees meeting, and they were speaking out against these two planned developments, saying basically, we just voted against this. How can you approve two more? So, and these are also larger. There is a 270 unit subdivision called Arborside that's planned off of State Route 132. And then a much larger 790 unit new urbanism style community called Stonelick Ridge that's planned off of Ross Road.
Wow. Now, is all of that this Arborside and Stonelick Ridge, are those developments on former farmland also?
They are. So they needed to have the zoning changed in order to go forward with the plan. And that is what trustees said. They approved that on Wednesday. They said, that's fine. And that's exactly the type of developments that voters had just fought against. So voters, you know, could potentially push back against these two developments, though. They now have 30 days to collect. It's just under 3,000 signatures they would need if they want to get another referendum on the ballot. And if they do that, they could potentially overturn these zoning changes in May.
How did township trustees explain their vote to the people who showed up and said, hey, we just went to the ballot to undo something like this?
Well, Batavia Township and the county as a whole is experiencing population growth. More people are moving there. There is a lack of housing and affordability crisis in housing. And so trustee officials and those who are in favor of the development say that these new homes are going to help solve that issue. There also is some tension between Batavia Township and the Village of Batavia, which is inside the township. One of the plots of land the village has tried to take hold of, and so the township kind of wanted to get to it first. And the other thing that the township is doing that it says is going to help residents is they didn't offer any tax abatements or incentives for any three of these properties. So, you know, homeowners who live on these properties are going to pay property tax, and that money is going to go back to schools, police, and fire. So that's something that the township thinks will help to alleviate those struggling services.
Well, there has been a lot going on. What are the implications of all of this for future development in Batavia Township?
Yeah, well, it's going to be more difficult to develop there with this ban on planned developments. And I think it just goes to show the effect that these types of developments have had throughout the region. You mentioned Hyde Park. You know, we're seeing this tension between growth and residents wanting to slow growth or at least control that growth. And it's just kind of boiled over here in this rural township.
Well, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much. I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Victoria Morwood and WVXU long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks.
Up next, the Bengals have more games on their schedule, but is the season basically over? This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. It has been a rough few weeks for Bengals fans. Is there any hope for the season? Joining me now to provide his unvarnished perspective is Local 12 News sports anchor and host of the Skinny Podcast, Richard Skinner. Welcome back, Skinny.
Thank you for having me, Lucy.
Well, we always appreciate your being here. Skinny, I know a lot of Bengals fans with a lot of heartburn right now. Let's start by just talking about these last couple of games against the Jets and the Bears. I mean, did the Bengals snatch defeat from the jaws of victory in these games, either one of them or both?
Yeah, they absolutely did. You know, the 2 weeks ago against the Jets, they're up by 15 points in the fourth quarter, blow the lead, then retake the lead, then blow the lead again, and lose 39-38. This past week, they were dead in the water. They're down 41-27 with under 2 minutes to go, score a touchdown. Then they get one of the most rare things in the NFL these days, recover an onside kick, go down and score again. Because they went for 2 points on the first touchdown, the second touchdown, they just had to kick an extra point to take a lead, which they did, up 42-41 with under a minute to go. And lo and behold, Chicago, a couple of plays down the field, a missed tackle on a pass play, and they go down and score to make it 47-42. That was the final score. So they have scored 38 and 42 points in back-to-back weeks and lost. There was a running joke last year. They were 1-4 in games in which they scored at least 30 points or more, that, you know, the Bengals can't even score 30 points and win. Now the joke is they can't even score 40 points and win.
You know, Skinny, I was walking around Covington last Sunday before the game, and I saw a Chicago Bears fan in a Pope costume. It made me wonder, do the Bengals need a Pope fan? Do you think that could help?
It wouldn't hurt. You know, there was the curse of the Billy Goat for the Chicago Cubs. They blew up a baseball, I think, from one of their previous World Series appearances, trying to change their luck. The Boston Red Sox had gone a long time without winning a World Series. I don't know exactly what they did for divine intervention, but some you got to find out to do something to break this curse.
Well, how's Joe Flacco doing? I mean, he seems to be getting points on the board.
He's been great. I'll be honest with you. When they made the trade for Joe Flacco, it was clearly out of desperation. Unfortunately, Jake Browning, who I thought would be a suitable replacement because he played really well 2 years ago when Joe Burrow got hurt, was just awful in three games. And they had to do something. Joe Flacco was probably the best quarterback available, but it didn't feel like, you know, much of an upgrade. I saw him in person in Cleveland this year when the Bengals beat him in the opener 17-16. He did okay, but he wasn't great. And I thought, okay, this is going to go, eh. I mean, you know, it was really one of those shrug the shoulders, doesn't move the needle much, but he's been fabulous. He was not very good in the first half of the Green Bay game, but he shouldn't have been. He was signed on a Tuesday and starting a game on a Sunday for a new team. And then in the second half, he led him to 18 points and really found some things he started to trust. He started to figure out how good Ja'Marr Chase was, how good T. Higgins was. And he actually talked about that. Like, I knew they were good, but until you play with those guys, you don't realize just how good. And he started trusting them with things. Gets the ball out of his hands quickly. Then he put 38 points up on the board against the Jets. Then, despite having a sprained AC joint that left him questionable for the Bears game, he goes out with a bad arm. And he had a bad arm. It was shot up with painkillers and all those things, but it was a bad arm. He threw, despite that bad arm, he throws for 470 yards. He should have been the story of the last 2 weeks. He sure as heck should have been the story of that Bears game for what he did. And he became nothing more than a footnote because they lost and the defense was so bad. It's a shame.
So the defense is still the big problem?
It's a big problem, and there's really no rectifying it in the short term. They've made bad draft picks. They're rolling the dice on a couple of rookie linebackers at the moment, who, according to ProFootballFocus.com, which is an analytics site, they grade players analytically. They're not the be-all, end-all. They're not the way coaches grade, but they're a measuring stick. One of the rookie linebackers, Demetrius Knight, is ranked 80th, graded 80th out of 82 linebackers in the NFL, and the other one, Barrett Carter's, ranked 82nd. You're playing with that in the middle of your defense. The safeties have just been, they weren't very good last year. They didn't think they needed to upgrade them, and they've been bad this year. They get absolutely no pass rush, and they get less pass rush when Trey Hendrickson's not playing, and he didn't play in this last game, and he's been playing hurt as well. This is something that's going to take a couple of off seasons to fix, either or both, through the draft and through free agency. But it's not going to get fixed anytime soon. Will it be bad enough to keep giving up high 30s, low 40s in points? Yeah, maybe you can take a small step forward there, but I don't think it's going to be a big step forward.
Well, running back Chase Brown made some post-game remarks that didn't sit well with head coach Zach Taylor. I don't want you to repeat those remarks because you can't say some of those words on the radio.
Expletive deleted.
That's right. Yeah, we don't want to have to use our time delay on you, Skinny. But give us the gist of what Chase Brown said and how Coach Taylor responded.
Yeah, the frustration boiled over for him where, you know, he was asked, you know, what can be done? And he said, well, just finish the game. Just finish the blanking game. And he's not wrong because that's clearly pointed at the defense. The offense went down, gave him the lead. The defense didn't finish it. But Zach Taylor on Monday, I thought he was right to kind of clap back at Chase Brown. And he said he didn't think it was appropriate because early in that game, and I recall I wrote a column in which I listed 8 different gaffes that they had in the game that cost them. And one of those was on a 3rd and 5, I think, deep in Bears territory. Chase Brown came on a nice little crossing route, was wide, wide open. He was at least going to get a first down, probably going to score a touchdown, and he dropped the ball. And Zach's comment to him was, listen, do your job. You know, you could have done something about that earlier in the game, right? And that's where when finger pointing starts, you better darn well be sure you're doing your job to the maximum of your ability and performance level before you can point fingers across the way. And I think that's why Zach was taken back. Now, I will tell people that are listening to this, Chase Brown is a wonderful kid. It was just a frustration in the moment. I've been in plenty of locker rooms where frustration in the moment can lead to regrettable things. I would guarantee you Chase probably regrets saying that. You know, Jamar Chase has been, he's a captain, so he's, to his credit, he has made sure he has the whole contingent of media around him when he speaks after games. But his frustration is palpable, but he's been very careful about choosing his words because I think he realized I am a captain and I can't get to that point. So, it was out of character of Chase Brown. The cat was out of the bag, and I don't think I blame Zach Taylor either for going back at Chase. I mean, you know, if you catch the ball early in the game, maybe we don't need the defense to finish the game there. Maybe we finish it on offense.
Well, I think some fans are wondering now whether the team needs to make some coaching changes, either with defensive coordinator Al Golden or with Zach Taylor himself. What do you think? Do you think that could make a difference?
I think it's above their pay grade, to be honest with you. They changed defensive coordinators after the last season. Lou Anarumo was the architect of the defense that went to the Super Bowl in the AFC Championship game. They decided that he was the problem with the defense last season because the defense was terrible last season. Not to the epic proportions, it's terrible this season, but it was bad last season. And that was probably the right thing to do. I think Lou's a great coach. Lou's having great success in Indianapolis at the moment. But sometimes in sports, there is change for change's sake. And that's what kind of this was. New voice in the room, maybe some new ideas. Then they basically brought the entire roster back. They added a free agent defensive tackle, TJ Slayton from the Packers. He's not played very well. They do have the 2 rookie linebackers that I just mentioned. They're not playing very well. But most of the rest of that defensive side of the ball are the same guys that weren't very good last year. They thought it was the coordinator. It's not the coordinator. It's the people making the personnel decisions. Duke Tobin, the director of player personnel, chief among them. He has had some really bad drafts of late since 2022. He's had a lot of first, second, and third round draft picks who aren't playing at all or playing very poorly. You can't have that. When the Bengals had success in the early part of the 2020s, going to the Super Bowl, going to the AFC Championship game, Joe Burrow was on a rookie contract. Jamar Chase was on a rookie contract. T. Higgins was on a rookie contract. And so they spent a lot of money on defense, on free agents, Von Bell, Larry Ogunjobi, Trey Hendrickson, and kind of threw money at the Chidobe Awuzie, a cornerback. And it worked. You were able to do that because you had your stars on rookie contracts. Well, now your stars are all being paid at market rates, which are very high. Joe Burrow is one of the highest paid quarterbacks in the NFL. For a brief moment, Jamar Chase was the highest paid non-quarterback in the NFL. T. Higgins is a number 2 wide receiver making number 1 wide receiver money at $30 million. Trey Hendrickson is getting paid $30 million this year. So when you have that circumstance, you have to have guys on rookie contracts, which is they're under rookie contracts the first 4 years in the league. It's literally set in stone of what you make those first 4 years. You have to have those guys contributing, and many of them contributing, and the Bengals just don't. They're contributing, but not at a very high level. In fact, a lot of times at a minimal level.
Mm. So it sounds like you're saying this is a front office problem.
Big time.
Okay. Well, there are still a bunch of games left to play, but is the season basically over for the Bengals?
Mathematically, it's obviously not. They're in a division where the Steelers still have some tough games ahead of them. The Bengals get to play the Steelers, the game coming out of the bye, not this weekend because this is the bye week. Next Sunday is when they go to Pittsburgh and play the Steelers. They still play Baltimore twice, so you kind of control your destiny there. But probably in the next 5 games they play, which is at Pittsburgh, Then they come home to play New England. Then they go to go to Baltimore on Thanksgiving night. Then go to Buffalo. Then come back home and play Baltimore. They will probably be betting underdogs in all five of those games. So it's a steep hill to climb for them. I mean, it's six losses. You're hoping 9-8 wins the division at that point. Even at 9-8, you're asking this team to go 6-2 over its last eight games. I just think that's a big ask.
Well, what could save the season if Joe Burrow gets healthy enough to start? Could he come in and save the season?
I'll be honest with you. Most of the games they've lost this year, some of the earlier ones at Denver, when they only scored, the offense only scored 3 points, the defense gave up 500 yards at Minnesota. You know, these last two games, I don't think Joe Burrow would have saved any of those games. I mean, he's a great quarterback. There's no denying that. He's certainly a better quarterback than Joe Flacco, but I don't think he would be doing maybe some of the things Joe Flacco is doing at the moment. And if he did, if he even replicated those things, they still would have lost these games. So, I mean, the hope would be that you stay afloat until Burrow comes back. But at the way Joe Flacco's playing, I just don't know if the difference is monumental. Again, there is in the long term. I mean, don't get me wrong. Joe Burrow is going to be a generational quarterback for the next 5 years, and Joe Flacco is going to be in retirement here in the next year or two. But I don't think Joe Burrow would have saved any of the games they've lost so far.
Okay, Skinny, I heard you say on your podcast that fans should be rooting for the chaos at this point. Why is that?
Well, I just think that this is an organization that's really slow to make change. And I can recall back in 2002, towards the end of the year, it was a disastrous year under Dick LeBeau. Fans stopped coming. I mean, I think one of the games I covered against the Saints were like 25,000 people in attendance. And I think it spoke volumes to the front office. And the next year they hired Marvin Lewis, and they gave Marvin Lewis some control. Marvin had some control of personnel decisions. But they just, I think the only way that they make change is when things hit rock bottom and the fan base demands it. And it's hard for fans to demand it because you want to go to the games. You want to love the games. You want to love everything about being at the games. But until chaos ensues, change probably doesn't take place. And so that's why I say you got to root for the chaos.
Wow. So it's gonna be empty seats that change the minds of the front office, you think?
It's amazing what pocketbooks do.
Oh, Skinny. I don't know. You're not making me feel very good. Although it's a bye weekend, so we don't have to worry about the Bengals losing this weekend, right?
Yeah, well, here's the running joke, though, that the bye is favored to beat the Bengals by 4.5 points. So there you go.
Ouch. Ouch. Well, I've been talking with Local 12 News sports anchor and host of the Skinny Podcast, Richard Skinner. Thanks so much for being here, Skinny. I hope you enjoy the weekend without a Bengals game to cover.
Thanks, Lucy. I appreciate it. Have a good one.
You too. The bye to beat the Bengals. That was hurtful. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening. And be sure to listen on Monday because we're going to have our pet show. It's always a fun one. Thanks for listening.